This is not to say that other student groups I don't speak about on the paper are not important, such as students from other language communities or students with special needs, or that inequities on the basis of other social categories like gender, sexuality, etc. do not exist. But I hope that my paper can also elicit some reflection about how other student groups are positioned in and affected by these problems. This said, and as Patricia noted yesterday, it has been over 20 years since Guadalupe Valdez issued her cautionary, if not prophetic, note, calling attention to the latent pitfalls of dual language education and their potential to exacerbate power asymmetries by giving children from the dominant group, namely white middle class English speakers, and I'm naming it, access to Spanish mastery, and in doing so, increasing and perpetuating their domination over Latinos. More recently, scholars have also expressed increasing concern over the ways in which market-based orientations, interest convergence, and linguistic commodification become the moral compass in many of these programs.
Kalia, where do you want me to be in the slide?
That one is good.
Okay.
So my paper...
Yes.
My paper is organized in these six sections, and I'm not going to elaborate on all of it right now, but I just want to emphasize that the first section provides a framework to understand the arguments that I make on the rest of the paper, so I want to spend a little time on that, and also because it frames other papers as I So, next slide. Thank you. I attempt to make a case for understanding the equity challenges in dual language, that equity challenges in dual language should be considered as part of a long legacy of racial linguistic tensions in the United States, generated by the nation's colonial and imperialistic history. I know this might sound like, whoa, you're way out there, but hang in there with me. And so therefore, any future planning should consider dual language education within the evolution of bilingual education and within the socio-political background that continues to shape current conditions for educational initiatives. Bilingual education is of unique significance to the Latinx community. Historically, for many Latinos, particularly Chicanos or Mexican Americans in the Southwest, and for Puerto Ricans, language has been a tool of power, with English dominance reflecting the material conditions of U.S. imperialism and the land invasion. So that's colonialism right there for you. And I'm not even starting where that should be in terms of settler colonialism. But needless to say, for these communities, bilingual education is inherently a highly politicized issue and a central one that emerged during the civil rights movements of the 1960s. So citing Trujillo and Nelson's work, my paper offers two examples of the radical vision that Chicanos and Puerto Rican civil rights activists had in mind in their initial conception of bilingual education, which involved bilingual education not as an end itself, and not as the way necessary to learn English, but as a means towards decolonization. Such vision highly contrasts with the vision of accommodation that has characterized the post-civil rights institutionalization of bilingual education, and thereby dual language. The accommodation approach has entailed, even if unintendedly or strategically so, a continuous effort to depoliticize bilingual education and merge it with hegemonic ideologies in order to gain acceptance, resources, and access to the dominant structures, precisely the approach that guides the implementation of many dual language programs today. These ideologies can be recognized in the intellectual or scientific frameworks that we use, the purposes of the program that are articulated, the language views, methods, and curriculum that have dominated bilingual education in the past 40 years, in ways that largely erase the race radical goals of civil rights activists. It is also visible in the embracement of an assets approach or language as resource orientation, which is the very foundation of the reemergence of bilingual education as dual language, and which paradoxically has brought about the very issues of inequity that are so pervasive today. Such orientation positions minoritized languages as desirable assets for economic development and national defense, which was viewed as a way to increase the status of minoritized languages, reduce divisiveness in opposition to bilingual education, and counter deficit thinking about language minoritized children and the remedial connotation of bilingual education. All good intentions, right? All good things. But this perspective gave way to the formulation of dual language programs precisely during a time of increased hostility against bilingual education, the rise of restrictive language policies, and a strong discourse of transitional bilingual education as a failing program. The two-way dual language model was also welcomed by foreign language educators whose field was struggling to survive declining public interest and funding allocations, as well as by English-speaking mainstream families motivated by increased research on the cognitive advantages of bilingualism. So dual language is not something that just came out as a good idea or simply as, oh, look at what the Canadians are doing, we should do that, it looks so cool. No, it comes from, you know, a multitude of interests and in a particular economic and political context. However, a number of scholars have revealed how embracing the assets orientation a bit too hastily and uncritically may very well lead to the commodification of minoritized languages and the co-optation or gentrification of bilingual education, largely for the benefit of the dominant group and without any commitment to social transformation. I should note here that I don't take issue with English speakers learning other languages. I think that's beautiful, that's a beautiful thing and should be encouraged. My concern is with the fine line between learning and cultural appropriation that often gets crossed when we don't check the principles motivating such learning. That is, I am concerned about extracting a resource from minoritized groups while simultaneously contributing to their dispossession, or at least not doing anything to transform the fundamental structures of society that oppress them. In other words, it's important to recognize that bilingualism or dual language instruction, or instruction in two languages, is not what makes two-way immersion programs unique. It's not, because we've had bilingual education programs in existence for a long time for language minoritized students. It is the presence of the invitation of English speakers to join dual language learners in the same bilingual classroom what makes these programs different, and which is precisely what brings a new set of challenges to the table. Next slide. And this is a crazy slide that you may need to, yeah, I tried to fix this, but I'm not going to fix this problem. So the next section of my paper identifies five equity goals that have been articulated in the literature on dual language. These include increasing English learners' grade level achievement and closing achievement gaps, 2, eliminating the segregation of language minoritized students, 3, promoting additive bilingualism, 4, equalizing the status of diverse students and fostering a healthy bilingual bicultural identity among students from historically marginalized communities, and 5, promoting higher levels of family and community engagement in the education of children from minoritized groups. I'm not going to describe each of these equity goals for you here, as I think you're quite familiar with them. Instead, I want to focus on the challenges to attain such goals. A recent review of the literature that colleagues and I conducted showed the pervasive challenges of power and status that remain in dual language despite its equity goals, revealing dual language programs' difficulties to truly equalize the status of English speakers and language minoritized students. On this paper, I argue that issues of equity stem from the dominance of hegemonic whiteness in dual language. You might wonder what I mean by hegemonic whiteness. Well, ask Nelson. He can tell you better. Nelson refers to hegemonic whiteness as a representation. Tell me if I'm mischaracterizing this. As a representation of the idealized white subject that originated within the race of nation states and colonization and perpetuated through the spread of global capitalism. In other words, it is, and I quote Nelson, what the ideal white person should be and act like in terms of his or her look, demeanor, sexual behaviors, gender identity, language practices, and so on. Such an inherently white supremacist notion of the idealized subject constitutes the normative frame of reference to which all subjects should aspire, all while perpetually positioned in the racialized other in direct opposition. Flores posits that in a society with hierarchy structured by hegemonic whiteness, the language and research orientation and the idea of bilingualism for all that are foundational in dual language are likely to benefit those who most closely fit this normative frame, namely white affluent families. For example, besides the theoretically and empirically found benefits of integration that I discuss in the paper, there is an underlying assumption that through cross-cultural interaction, students from minoritized groups will acquire the cultural capital of the dominant group. That is, the aspirations, the attitudes, the literacies, and ways of being and speaking of the powerful. Such assumption implicitly positions the dominant culture as a norm and as a standard measure of worthiness, which is reinscribed and perpetuated in the classroom by curriculum, assessments, sanctioned language practices, and interactions, as well as by policies, decision-making, and cultural practices at the school and community levels. Not at the school community. On my paper, I also identified two salient ways in which hegemonic whiteness materializes in dual language. You can click like a million times until something comes out. There. You see, I was trying to get pretty So hegemonic whiteness, through linguistic domination, involves the hegemony of standardized English, evident in the priority it receives in accountability measures, towards course credit, toward the purchasing of resources, and therefore instruction in the partner language is often significantly reduced, particularly as students move up in grades. English also tends to be the language that dominates in larger school communities, such as by teachers or special subjects, librarians, administrators, etc., making English a non-negotiable language, suggesting that while English speakers' bilingualism is to be celebrated as an exceptional accomplishment, no matter how low the Spanish or whatever partner language proficiency levels are, bilingualism for language minoritized students is to be anticipated and demanded. It is important to know that it is hegemonic whiteness and not solely English that structures linguistic hierarchies. Even when increased, the use of Spanish, for example, is not enough to equalize the status of the languages and the speakers, as in many cases, only the standardized variety of Spanish, another phase of hegemonic whiteness, is valued, and the authentic language practices of working class simultaneous Latinx dual language learners are still implicitly framed as efficient. In this way, the home language is again positioned as a source of shame, further perpetuating standardized English hegemony. There is then no surprise that as time goes by, language minoritized students tend to use and favor English in social interactions with peers, as well as for academic purposes. And its impact has been captured by ethnographic and qualitative studies revealing language minoritized students' decreased confidence in their Spanish proficiency and the internalization of English as a marker of success and higher social status. Inequities also occur as the pervasive dominance of English gives greater opportunities to Anglophones to demand attention to their needs, assert authority, and dominate classroom discourse. And there's plenty of research on this, okay? While silencing and marginalizing language minoritized students, even in the bilingual classroom. In turn, such attitudes can influence teachers' perceptions and expectations, positioning English speakers as more participative and thus as more invested, more confident, more academically competent, and even more bilingually proficient. In this way, the implicit thinking about language minority students is reproduced to the detriment of the academic identities and to their opportunities to access rigorous and additive bilingual instruction. So, interest conversion is another phase of hegemonic whiteness that I talk about in the paper. The theory of interest convergence posits that policy changes for racial integration and equity are not motivated by moral obligations, but by the degree to which the dominant group perceives that such policies will benefit them. Through this lens, integration in dual language offers language minority students access to additive bilingual education, but only insofar as it advances the interests of the white middle class community. This leaves dual language in a difficult position to pursue social justice and address inequities, as the interests of the dominant group are prioritized in order to maintain the viability of the program. That is, even when communities are consulted, their voices more likely to receive attention, and the needs and interests to priority are those of the middle-class white community. For example, Herena's qualitative study of a dual language program established in an urban community in Southern California to intentionally promote equity showed that after 2 years, even when Anglophone parents had developed more positive attitudes and empathy towards Latinx parents and students, little was done to address the needs of the language minoritized community, such as providing bilingual office staff, basic things, right? In this case, Latinx parents had to organize and campaign on the one hand to promote the program among English-speaking families so they could have it, while simultaneously advocating at the school district level for more support for their needs. Dorner's research also found that in the public debates about the development of a dual language program in the Midwest, not only did English-speaking parents' voices dominate, but the district's final decisions ultimately privileged the desires of the white dominant group over those of the immigrant communities. Even when administrators may deliberately work against the domination of white parents, Burns found that structural factors like lack of funding create the conditions that perpetuate white parents' influence. The ways in which language minoritized communities are disadvantaged within the interest convergence dynamic has also been evident in the inequitable ways in which districts promote and offer information to parents about dual language programs and in recruitment and enrollment processes. And I could share more studies that have been conducted about this happening, but I want to take more time on that. But I hope this is clear of how interest convergence operates in dual language programs. In some evidence of persistent inequities, behooves us to reconsider the extent to which a social justice agenda can be realistically followed when hegemonic whiteness and neoliberal ideologies remain foundational to dual language education. And through my paper, I challenge us to reimagine the frameworks that could replace hegemonic whiteness as a guiding principle. Okay, next slide. Thank you. The next section of my paper identifies three specific contexts where dual language is being increasingly embraced and that deserve further consideration because of the stark power asymmetries between linguistic groups that emerge here. These contexts include historically segregated communities and paths of gentrification, regions with a relatively recent surge in the Latinx population, but without a long-standing presence of bilingual education, and places with restrictive language policies. While some communities may fall in more than one of these categories, it is important to recognize how these contexts exacerbate challenges to social justice and equity, as well as to locate possibilities for agency. Recent research has offered insight about ways in which gentrification processes and dual language merge. In these contexts, the participation of white affluent families may be discursively framed as a way to save failing schools, characterized by pervasive segregation and declining test scores. Meanwhile, dual language programs fit the choice discourse along vouchers and charter schools and are a way to rebrand schools as urban amenities. Because stark socioeconomic disparities are almost always present in these settings, vulnerabilities to hegemonic whiteness are exacerbated. And I'd like to share Muro's study as an example because I think it illustrates so well. Her study of parental involvement in a dual language school here in LA shed light on how social inequalities in the larger society were reproduced in the school with white affluent parents leading the PTA in organizing events, while Latina immigrant mothers prepared and served food. Right? A white parent even expressed appreciation of the dual language program because it would prepare their child to communicate in the future with his workers. So there's already an expectation of what this is for. And while white affluent parents view socioeconomic diversity as fun, yeah, it's so cool to be in a diverse school, right? Latina mothers actually express apprehension about how their lack of resources limit to their children. So diversity is not an urban amenity for everyone, right? Regions with a relatively recent surge in the Latinx population, but without a long-standing presence in bilingual education, like the U.S. South, some places in the Midwest, and in states like Utah, where dual language education has boomed, pose similar risks. Some of the additional challenges include the lack of locally grown Latinx bilingual teachers with the necessary sensitivity to issues of power and race or class tensions, as well as the state's lack of experience in general with cultural and linguistic diversity outside of the black and white binary and with bilingual education. Most concerning is the intentional positioning of English speakers as the main beneficiaries of dual language. Because many of the dual language programs in these settings are created under the umbrella of oral language education, equity and social justice goals can be easily relegated to the margins. And then the third place would be places with restrictive language policies, like Arizona, don't forget about us. And I can talk a little bit more about that, but while severely constricting, the law does not ban bilingual education completely, but the ways in which state education officials interpret its waiver system has gradually increased restrictions and systematically excluded the English learners who would benefit most from dual language, even though dual language programs are booming, right? in Arizona. So that's a good example of the gentrification of dual language. Okay, the next slide. My paper then brings attention to two communities that tend to be made invisible in dominant conceptions of dual language. Black students and indigenous students from Mexico and other parts of Latin America, actually native peoples from all of the Americas, are largely made invisible. I won't go into detail about each of these groups, but I will say now, for now, that as in the case of many Latino students who are simultaneous bilinguals and who do not fit the native English speaker or the native Spanish speaker boxes, these two groups often present linguistic variations from English and Spanish, respectively, that tend to be either ignored or perceived as unfit for dual language programs. In addition, their cultural heritage, histories, and values tend to be ignored or minimized in white student curriculum. There is also an erasure, and I did not include much of this on my paper, but of those programs where most, if not all, students are Latinos, right? Like students on border. And there's plenty of those that we pay very little attention to in order to inform our programs and what they should be, right? Next slide. And so the last sections of my paper, in those sections I note that changes for social justice and dual language should encompass considerations of current realities while striving to transform them. This is indeed a formidable challenge that will require great caution, new approaches to research, ongoing collaborative efforts, and the boldness to engage in continuous reflection, self-critique, and willingness to change the course of action. I challenge us to consider whether our research is asking the most urgent and necessary questions, also about what research is being silenced by generalizations about dual language, research that very well exists, and whether the approaches that we privilege in our conceptions of valid science may need to be recalibrated. I present here recommendations from some of the work that I know, but to be underway, certainly not the only work possible or already taking place. This is in hopes to elicit further dialogue to reimagine the possibilities of dual language. Colleagues and I have proposed the addition of critical consciousness as the fourth pillar in conceptualization of dual language. We draw from critical theory and critical pedagogies to define critical consciousness as a process of overcoming pervasive myths through a deep understanding of the role of power in the formation of oppressive conditions. The addition of critical consciousness as a fourth pillar in dual language implies that all stakeholders, including teachers, parents, administrators, and children from all groups, are responsible for engaging in the growing awareness of the structural oppression in society and readiness to take action to correct it. It also involves specific elements such as interrogating power, critical listening, historicizing schools and communities, and embracing discomfort. And I will say that my colleagues have been sharing this work with practitioners, and it has been taken very well. And I'm sure that I can share more of that. Also, based on the material turn, the field of applied linguistics, which seeks to bring attention to the links between power, between language and the political economic conditions of colonialism and global capitalism and neoliberalism, Flores and Chaparro argue for a new materialist, anti-racist paradigm in language policy activism. This approach would demand explicit connections between language education and other efforts that seek to address societal inequities caused by multiple factors such as poverty, racism, and xenophobia. To illustrate this point, this kind of activism would involve, for example, enacting bilingual education programs in affluent and gentrifying neighborhoods as part of a number of initiatives with a larger goal of creating economic integration, such as the development of affordable housing in the surrounding neighborhoods. Such efforts are already taking place in some communities. For example, We Love Community, a comprehensive, sustainable, a grassroots organization in St. Louis, Missouri, that started a dual language program, works exclusively on comprehensive sustainable solutions for economic equity, sustainability, and equitable population distribution through strategies that focus on building equity in schools, at work, and at home. Finally, efforts to undo colonialist and neoliberal orientations in dual language necessitate new radical theoretical visions and epistemic sources for the curriculum and pedagogical practices, particularly in preparation of bilingual teachers. Such visions must expose not only the very colonial legacies that continue to shape power configurations and material realities, and which make hegemonic whiteness so pervasive, This shift should draw from and build the imaginaries, ingenuity, and epistemic resources of the very communities that have been excluded in conceptions of valid knowledge. And so, for example, I have proposed elsewhere that using an anti-colonial Chicana feminist framework in the preparation of Latinx bilingual teachers may help build such vision and path. And I'll tell you more about that later. But part of this vision should consider collective forms of agency by thoughtfully exploring potential connections to other anti-colonial agendas and grassroots efforts in education, such as the recent movements for ethnic studies in a number of states. These recommendations converge in the realization that conceiving dual language in purely linguistic, cognitive, and academic terms is not enough to address the pervasive marginalization of language minoritized students and other youth of color. Ambitious visions and agendas that address the roots of power asymmetries and the everyday realities that they generate are necessary to enact substantive change. Thank you.
Thank you so much for this opportunity to present here. This is a really tremendous honor. Thank you for the invitation. It's kind of an honor to be here with scholars whose work were the work that inspired my work. And it's an honor to be this responding to my academic admana here, where you can tell that we have a lot of things of interest in common and kind of are constantly supporting one another. So I appreciate having the opportunity to respond. Patricia asked me to not kind of just say, yes, I agree with everything that she said, because it's clear that we agree on a lot of things, but to really try to think about what some tensions that we can maybe think about as a group together are, and that's what I'm going to try to do a little bit of. But first I wanted to kind of just talk a little bit about kind of my perspective on dual language education, on bilingual education in general, and how I see that connecting to the issue that Kelly is raising. So I take a genealogical perspective to the study of discourse. And what that means is that I'm looking at the historical formation of discourse and then tracing these discourses in contemporary debates. So how do we talk about the things that we talk about them? What are the historical factors that led us to talk about the things and the ways that we talk about them? And what are the power relations that went into the creation of those ways of talking about things? With the important goal of then thinking about, do we still want to talk about things in that way, or do we want to be more mindful of talking about things in a different way? And so oftentimes the work feels very theoretical, but it actually is very much interested in thinking about practice and how maybe we're not thinking about practice in the ways that we could, or maybe there are other ways that we could also be thinking about the issues in addition to the ways that we currently think about the issues, and kind of think about the tensions that may arise, the productive tensions that may create for us. And so Claudia did a great job of kind of thinking about some of the historical context of the development of bilingual education. And so I'm currently working on a book proposal, it's not a book project yet, looking at the institutionalization of bilingual education in the post-civil rights era. And just to kind of add some kind of context, the context that Claudia already added for us. Thinking about the rise of bilingual education as occurring within a context where people were demanding community control of schools, which was a thing that, like, people still talk about it some now, but it's not as currently prominent in the field now as people were talking about it in the 1960s. And so you had these two different discursive formations that were at play during this discussion of community control. And I think Claudia talked about race radicalism, which situated calls for bilingual education within a broader context of global revolution, which was happening at the time, right? There were lots of changes happening in the 60s and 70s that people who were working within the context of the civil rights movement oftentimes saw themselves as working in solidarity with. But oftentimes when that history gets told, the broader international perspective of many of these advocates kind of also gets lost. It kind of takes a very US perspective when many of these activists didn't see themselves as working solely on struggles in the U.S., right, that saw themselves as working in solidarity with the self-determination of racialized communities around the world, which was happening at the time in the context of colonial struggles against colonial rule. Vietnam being, of course, a prominent one that was happening at the time. But for these race radical advocates, bilingual education was then seen as part of broader efforts at decolonization, self-determination, economic development, It wasn't an end in and of itself. It was seen as part of a larger end, right? Of community transformation, of social transformation. Another discursive formation that I also look at, and I think you maybe alluded to in your paper, that I would like us to get to think about a little more explicitly, is what I call liberal multiculturalism. Liberal multiculturalism situated calls for bilingual education in the 60s within the culture of poverty hypothesis or thesis that suggested that racial oppression had created cultural and linguistic deficiencies within racialized communities. So in the 60s, you also get the rise of the war on poverty, which did a lot of great things for communities, but was informed by this culture of poverty thesis that said the reason that these communities are struggling is because they have inherent cultural and linguistic deficiencies, and that we want to create compensatory programs to fix those cultural and linguistic deficiencies. And so in this context, bilingual education becomes framed as part of broader efforts at addressing these cultural and linguistic deficiencies. Now, while in some of my previous work I talked about them as kind of separate in some ways, and they are, when you look at the activists at the time, they weren't necessarily talking about it in these separate ways, right? And so in the moment, people are always merging discourses in interesting and sometimes contradictory ways. But at the core of why these two perspectives were able to come together, and even if it was a precarious alliance, was because at the core of both of them was what I call a psychologically damaged racialized subject was at the core of both of these perspectives. And so the liberal multicultural kind of discursive formation of this psychologically damaged racialized subject, I think is worth reflecting on in this context, kind of emerges from, if you look at the Brown v. Board of Education decision. So Uju Arbour looks at the kind of does a discourse analysis of the Brown v. Board of Education decision and found that the decision really focused primarily on the psychological harm done by segregation to the internal psyche of black children. So if you think of the Dahl experiment, which was kind of seminal in getting this court case won, it was really focused on the psychological damage of segregation to black children as opposed to the structural barriers that black communities confronted. And this kind of gets taken up in educational debates in the Coleman Report, which became a very influential report in the 60s that pointed to the pathologies or the supposed pathologies of black communities that were caused by legacies of racism as lying at the root of racial inequality. So this perspective acknowledges that racism was a thing and that it had impacted communities, but it's not focusing on the structural barriers that has created, the material inequalities that has produced, but instead is looking at the psychological damage of it on communities of color, black communities, and eventually Puerto Rican and Mexican American communities, and then sees the solution then as fixing those communities rather than actually addressing the material inequalities that racism over multiple generations had been allowed to produce. But the race radical perspective also has this psychologically damaged kind of racialized subject, and I'm kind of trace this to the work of Frantz Fanon, who was a prominent post-colonial theorist, who looked at the psychological effects of colonialism on Africans. And this was eventually taken up by the black power advocates in the US and then other groups that were modeling themselves after the black power advocates, including the Young Lords, which is a Puerto Rican kind of nationalist group that I've done some research around, who talked about psychological imperialism. And so they're kind of merging this material analysis with the psychological analysis. But there's a fine line between a psychologically damaged racialized subject who needs liberation from colonialism and a psychologically damaged racialized subject who needs to be fixed and uplifted out of the culture of poverty. And I think that kind of tension is one that I would like us to kind of think about and reflect on a little bit. And so the psychologically damaged racialized subject is also at the core of the debates on the Bilingual Education Act, which is of course emerging in this context that I kind of have situated for you. And so the debate was framed around kind of the transitional versus maintenance was kind of like the dominant way of like thinking about bilingual education at the time, and to some extent perhaps still today. But neither of them necessarily suggested that there was anything wrong with this framing of Latinx and other racialized communities as psychologically damaged or linguistically deficient. It was just in terms of what the solution was. So transitional, people who advocated transitional programs saw Spanish as a temporary tool for overcoming psychological and linguistic deficiencies that would then allow these people to successfully assimilate into the mainstream culture. Whereas those who supported the maintenance model didn't necessarily say that there weren't linguistic deficiencies or cultural deficiencies that needed to be overcome, but a more maintenance or more developmental, I guess what it would be called now, model would restore the linguistic heritage of Latinx students in ways that would help them to better overcome their psychological and linguistic deficiencies. And so both of these perspectives erase the histories of colonialism that Claudia is really trying to get us to really think about. And it does this in at least two ways, although perhaps more than two ways. One is, and this is a discourse analysis I've done of the Bilingual Education Act debates around it, was the conflation of Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans with European immigrants, as if the histories of those communities were the same, whereas we know that Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans have a different history of colonialism that impacts the ways that they may access institutions. But there was also, and I think oftentimes not recognized, a conflation of indigenous communities with speakers of European languages. And so indigenous communities were actually mentioned very little in the debates, the analysis I've done so far, but when they were mentioned, it oftentimes was just on a long list of, we have like German speakers, and then we may have like Native Americans who speak Native American languages, as if that history is the same. But of course, we know that indigenous communities have a whole different relationship to the United States that's even different than the relationship of Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans who do speak a European language. And I think that was completely overlooked in the debates. And so the implication of the discourse of the BEA was that fixing the cultural and linguistic deficiencies of racialized students, in that context, it was all talked about in terms of Latinx students, although that wasn't a term that was used at the time, would resolve racial inequalities with little need for the material redistribution of resources to remedy the multiple generations of white wealth accumulation that had been made possible through the colonization and exploitation of racialized communities. So as a result, the institutionalization of bilingual education served to reify rather than challenge the structural effects of colonialism. And this is not meant as a criticism of those who were advocating for the Bilingual Education Act. A genealogical perspective isn't about individuals, right? It's about the historical formations of particular ideas and what made them possible, and then the impacts of those. And so I have the gift of hindsight to look at the ways that these things get taken up, and I don't mean that to suggest that the people who were doing it had any nefarious agendas or any of that sense. I will imagine 50 years from now, people will look back at the things I'm saying now and say, wow, you really missed all of these things that we now know because of the historical developments of the field, right? The impacts of this, kind of, just to give you an example of how this erasure of this colonial history gets taken up, is through the accountability measures that were connected to the Bilingual Education Act. So what I find interesting in terms of discussions of like standards-based reform and accountability is that people usually identify the origins as a nation at risk. But I actually think that's inaccurate. The Bilingual Education Act actually had accountability systems associated with it before that. And so in some ways, the Bilingual Education Act provides a precursor to what then becomes what we now call accountability. So one of the requirements of the BEA was evaluating students to determine eligibility for bilingual education and to monitor progress. So some students tested were tested as not fully proficient in either English or Spanish, and this connects back to a point that I made yesterday. That's not, from a linguistic perspective, that's not like a theoretical possibility for someone to not be fully proficient in any language. But at the time, that wasn't necessarily something that people were really thinking about, or that people were coming from different theoretical perspectives on that. And so these students were labeled semilingual. And the term doesn't exist anymore. People don't really use the term anymore. But early proponents of the term semilingual then kind of changed it to a focus on lacking academic language. Mm-hmm. Now, the concept of academic language certainly does still exist, and it's oftentimes used on a daily basis with the teachers I work with in classrooms. Oftentimes with a lot of reflection on what they mean by it. And so bilingual education from this perspective became framed as building a, quote, strong foundation in Spanish that could then be transferred to English. And again, from a linguistic perspective, everyone has a strong foundation that the language practice they're socialized into at home. But at the same time, this is how students are being described. And so I think we need to think about what exactly is meant by not having a strong foundation, if we could be more precise in how it is, what we actually mean by that, because I think we're trying to describe something, but maybe we're describing it in a way that's not precise enough, and that may be taken up in ways that we actually don't support. And so scholars and practitioners who use the academic language framework see themselves as advocates for Latinx and other minoritized communities, and they certainly are. They're certainly trying to create spaces that are more linguistically and pedagogically responsive. There continue to be certain overlaps between the framing of Latinx and other racialized students today and the culture of poverty thesis. And so I worry about that. I worry about that continued connection. And I worry about the continued reification of racialization that those perspectives, when used unreflexively, may actually contribute to. And so I think Claudia is getting us to also think about kind of the reifications of racialization in contemporary discussions of dual language education. And so the rise of dual language education shift bilingual education and discussions of bilingual education from focusing on fixing the perceived linguistic and cultural deficits of Latinx and other minoritized students to providing access to all children, right? So that's a discursive shift that someone with a genealogy is interested in, like these discursive shifts that happen and what leads to them. Though it's an important shift in some ways and certainly has changed how people talk about bilingual education and has opened up spaces that maybe wouldn't have existed without that shift. It does little to address or challenge the deficit perspectives that were associated with the culture of poverty. It simply kind of shifts the focus completely away from talking about Latinx and other minoritized communities as a specific group of students, and instead kind of shifts the focus towards competitiveness and the global economy for all. And so I think most relevant to our conversation is sticking to the focus on integration within this broader neoliberal context. And so I think Claudia kind of at least implies or explicitly talks about some of the ways that the focus on integration needs to be kind of critically thought about, and so how we do it in a way that actually is equitable, because as we know, integration is not inherently equitable, how it's done and how it's implemented, right? And so one kind of issue is the assumption that white students are a necessary ingredient in the success of Latinx and other racialized students. And so the echoing previous efforts at integration, the contemporary framing of dual language education typically assumes and takes for granted that mixing Latinx with white students is necessary for remediating their cultural and linguistic deficiencies, a framing that will inevitably continue to reify the marginalization of Latinx should it continue to go unchallenged. The second assumption of integration that needs to be critically thought about is framing native English speakers, as in a quote, as white. So integration is typically defined as bringing together white students and students of color. The systematic exclusion of African Americans then becomes an issue here. So there's research that indicates that African American students are being systematically denied access to dual language programs, oftentimes utilizing similar deficit perspectives of their language practice or cultural practices as justification for why they shouldn't be in the programs. So within this context, we have a great deal of work to do if Spanish is to become the quote great equalizer, which you mentioned in your paper, between African American students and their white peers. It's not as simple as that, I think it's much more complicated. And then what about Latinx native English speakers, who exist? Are native speakers of other racial backgrounds, who also exist, native English speakers? And so the final is kind of that most Latinx and African American students continue to attend hyper-segregated and low-income schools in low-income areas. So what's interesting, of course, at least in my context of Philadelphia, African Americans and Latinx students are already integrated together in schools. They go to schools together, but those schools are described as segregated. Because that's usually not what people are talking about when they're talking about integration. So focusing just on programs with white students in them, I worry, represents the gentrification of scholarship on bilingual education by shifting the focus away from minoritized bilingualism. So schools that I work with that have a long-standing Latinx community don't fit neatly into the models of one-way or two-way. They just don't, and people try to fit them in, and oftentimes they're doing all kinds of practices that just don't make sense, because there's no research to help them to think about this. And so the implication that unless schools fit neatly into existing models, that they're not worthy of attention or conversation, I think is one that we have to really reflect on. And then kind of just ending, I just want to kind of end by, kind of you talked about the materialist anti-racist framing, and really thinking about how we can begin conversations with researchers and activists who are examining and working to challenge the political and economic roots of racial inequalities broadly, and really thinking about how do we then develop policy proposals that situate struggles the Situate Dual Language Education Initiative within a comprehensive approach to dismantling the material effects of multiple generations of racial oppression. And so I think that Claudia does a great job of thinking of like one role of dual language education itself within that is to develop critical consciousness to help people kind of become aware of these histories of racial oppression that we have inherited. And I certainly think that that's important. However, I would just caution us to think about this in ways that avoid reifying that psychologically damaged, racialized subject that needs to be saved. Mm-hmm. And I'm not suggesting that you're saying this. I'm just suggesting mm-hmm. that
it can be
taken up in ways that suggest that we know and we have to go and teach these people how to think about these issues. And so I just think that that's something that we have to kind of reflect on and think about so that we can avoid making the mistakes of previous efforts at trying to integrate communities with vast differences in terms of their kind of social positions and kind of situate these efforts at integrating students within broader efforts to dismantle kind of the structural oppression and racism that I think people who advocate for dual language education oftentimes would like to think that we're doing, that that's what we're trying to do. So with that said, thank you very much.
Stand up to call on folks. I do want to add one additional cautionary note, though, as well. And that is the problem of reifying whiteness as being the contrast to Latinos or others in dual language programs. And the stereotyping of white as being middle class and the stereotyping of Latinos as being low-income, and African-Americans as being low-income individuals. I think we get ourselves into trouble with that. In this state, which is really a forerunner of what will happen in the rest of the country, actually Asian-Americans are the most advantaged group, have the highest levels of education and earnings, and are very, very overrepresented in our most rigorous universities. And white students are becoming under parity, less than their representation of the population. So things are changing and evolving. And I really appreciate the history that you and how so much of this got inserted into the war on poverty, which I think is very damaging. But I think we have to be constantly aware of the way our society is shifting and not get stuck in these rather reified stereotypes of who's who in this picture. So those are my added comments. And I open it up. I think that this should stimulate. I do also want to say that I deeply appreciate you bringing this to us, because these are issues we have to grapple with. And if we don't, I think the stakes are very high, and if we don't grapple with these issues, we run the risk of really undermining what I think everybody in this room thinks is a positive direction, but we will undermine that unless we attend to these. So this should provide an opening for lots of comment. Francesca.
Do you want to say our names again?
Yeah, which of you had been? Actually, we have a couple people with us today who weren't able to be here yesterday. And then Lucrecia Santibanez, Claremont University. And do we have somebody else here who joined us since yesterday? No? Okay. All right. But yeah, I think it's a good idea to restate your name.
Thank you both. I really, really enjoyed reading your paper. And I think there's several things I'm going to try to tie together in a succinct manner. So I think, Nelson, to your comment about, you know, the dangers of how, whether it's implicit or explicit, these deficit narratives that kind of tend to permeate with the best of intentions, right? One thing that could really address it, and I hope we have more conversations about this, was in your paper, Claudia, which is the critical consciousness or critical awareness piece. And I think that's something several of us have done in our work, is looking at what kind of knowledge do teachers really have to be effective with a historical view, right? Because when it's ahistorical, that's when you hit that slippery slope. And I think it's also important for us, and I've talked to others who are here in this room, that we really have a tendency not to talk to each other in different areas of work. And like, there's people I haven't cited that I think I should be citing, and vice versa. I think that our work really needs to speak to one another's work to really get a nuanced understanding. So I really thank you, Patricia, for putting this together. I think it's timely and exciting. But one thing I wanted to put out there is to consider, and this was also in your paper, Claudia, about like to approach this carefully because it's dangerous territory, right? And so a legal scholar, Ian Haney Lopez, right, who was one of Derek Bell's, wrote a book, A Dog Whistle Politics, that I think behooves us to understand how do these racialized things get out in society. And I think since our latest administration, it's become much more explicit than it was before. But by understanding that if we're looking at structures, right, so I'm going to use the ethnic studies example because I'm in Tucson. And so if you look at what happened, and the teachers who were teaching the Mexican American studies, they were front and center, and it got quashed, right? And I think that there's a danger if we're out there and saying things that are provocative without people being on board or without people really having the understanding to know what we mean. So I work with a district, and they are policed that they cannot say indigenous epistemologies. There are certain words they cannot use in their trainings, right? So it becomes this covert operation. Let's use language, right? And it is totally interest convergence. Because at the big level, we have to know we're operating in a system that is bound by power. And so I have a colleague who says, if we were able to turn the ship around a long time ago, we would have done so on our own, right? So there is this acknowledgement that sometimes we have to operate within interest convergence, but by training and making sure those who are on the ground have that critical awareness, that changes everything, which is why this is the kind of approach that is for everybody, right? Critical awareness for teachers is good for all students. Culturally or asset-based pedagogies are good for all students because that pedagogy requires a historical understanding that empowers students to have agency, and it's really the only way we're going to turn this around. I've often struggled myself in thinking, you know, in terms of integration. So when I moved back to Tucson as a Latina, I wanted my children who had lost their language because we had lived in Arizona, and it's very difficult to maintain Spanish on your own in your household, and I was turned down because I was Latina. And this is a school that was a magnet school, and they were trying to achieve integration, right? So the notion that a school that is trying to attract white students, right, was displacing Latinx families who want that recursive approach to language is very real, right? So we're navigating these spaces that are very, very difficult. So the last thing I want to say is I really hope we push in this room all this literature we're reading. So yesterday in Catherine's paper, she mentioned that the high density, high poverty schools had better outcomes. Why then do we conceptualize dual language as having to be 50-50? Why? If we know there's a power differential and we see that very often students might gain with, if we look at stereotype threat, with critical mass, why do we not then shift it so that we do allow those spaces to have groups of students who are maybe from minoritized communities, but that shift that weight a little bit? So yes, I know that was a lot out there, but thank you both, because I think this is really important to look at in our work.
I know everybody's got a problem. I'm Rhonda, and I'm so thankful for your paper. Really reading and like texting all the people. Oh my goodness, my home was erased. It made a huge difference, right? And there are still three communities that I think we haven't talked about that haven't come up in the five papers for this weekend, so not specifically yours because you do the broadest job. But I want to bring them to this room because I think the implications for research matter. For how we move forward next generation. And so one is schools that are working with African, schools that are located in communities that have very low population of native speaker or Spanish speaking populations who are still trying to do dual language work. Right, so you think about schools who are in populations in Ohio or Indianapolis or in Mississippi that don't have large Latinx communities. They may have 2%, they may have 3%. And so their work around bringing Black and white students together into a new language
I think needs some way to think about those communities that don't have large Latinx, large Chicano populations who are still trying to insert themselves in this work. And it may be from a commodification perspective, it may be about building broader solidarity, but there's just a lack of space for that, I think, because of where our research institutions are located and what populations we're looking at. I think there is a space where we talk about simultaneous bilinguals, we tend to be talking about newer American or Chicano population, Puerto Rican, Mexican, etc., and we erase in the research Black Americans who are simultaneous bilinguals, who are speaking, whether they're coming from recent waves of immigration from Ethiopia and Somalia and Eritrea, etc., or whether they're coming from many marginalized communities that have existed in the States for over 300 years. We're missing in the research. And my peers in Louisiana, Michelle Hodge-Broussard, does a great job of making this work for low-income African-American students who are in programs, but we need, when we think about solidarity in these movements, and solidarity in social justice and Black and Brown people in particular, when we are positioning the research as Black Americans as being outside of language minority communities, and coming into this conversation in solidarity with our language minority brothers and sisters, it erases the fact that we are, as part of the global majority, also multilingual people. And in this country, that we are also multilingual people. We came to this country as multilingual people. And there were very specific structural barriers that took our languages from us. And so whether that was coming from slavery or it was coming from more recent English-only expectations, and even census expectations around who gets counted. So when we look at all the research here that we presented, and we're saying, okay, and then African American populations have been erased, we're also erasing this group, which is Afro-Latinos. Latinos who are coming into this country were speaking their own indigenous languages or speaking other minority languages from their countries. In Louisiana, we have fast-growing Garifuna population, and it just put everyone on their head because they're like, we don't know what to do with this. We're trying to like put like some Mexican context on you, like, Mexican. Right? Like, you don't understand this. So like some attention to the fact that race and ethnicity and language minority status get conflated. And for those of us in communities where you are Black and multilingual, simultaneous bilingual, and minority in your country, and now you come here and you're a minority, you're a quadruple minority here, we're not showing up in the research. And it's making it so that when you get into the practitioner space within our schools, none of the tools that we have developed and none of the studies that are available to us speak to those three types of populations. And so if we could have, if in this space we could start to talk about the completion and intersectionality of our identities, I think that would mean a lot for the research. I know in broader education reform space, we're always pushing that as Black people and Black educators, we are not coming in solidarity with you, like we are in the same fight, we're facing the same structural barriers. And then also for our more recent immigrant populations, that Black Americans are also immigrants in lots of the newer discourse and get often relegated to you have an African American monolingual status, where you speak multiple registers of English, but we're erasing the fact that you're also a simultaneous bilingual and multiple languages, European and multiple languages.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Very fascinating papers, and I really enjoyed the comments. I have a very quick comment and then a question. The comment is actually to Patricia's point about Asians in California. I think a really interesting sort of avenue for research would be to study Chinese or Asian dual language programs, because the social power dynamics may be different, at least in California, and it would serve as an interesting comparison group for some things we're seeing in the Spanish dual immersion. And this comes because actually I was involved in a study of Pasadena where some UCLA researchers were doing the Mandarin program, and me and my colleague at Claremont were doing the Spanish, and we were actually finding very different things in that respect. My question is actually about something, Claudia, that you have in your paper. And so you have there an argument about the structural forces, and you cite funding, lack of funding, as being one of these sort of big push factors that in a way is creating this environment where, you know, school districts do see the, let's just call it middle class here in at least Southern California, parents as literally saving the schools because they're returning to, you know, in Pasadena they were about to close an elementary school. They refurbished it as, I really like the analogy, this urban amenity. of a Spanish dual immersion program, and it actually grew exponentially, and so literally the money came in. And so I'm just wondering if you have anything to say about how local control, you know, we have local control funding here in California, whether that is going to significantly affect those dynamics, or do you see that as exacerbating them even further?
Ooh, I really have nothing to say. That sounds really... I think I would defer that question to people who have more knowledge of that. That's really not something I feel that I have.
But in your research, or in the research that you cite, do you see the funding dimension as being very salient in generating these dynamics, just on the ground level?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think, so in Austin, where I've done a lot of my work, that is a huge impetus of, you know, why they're trying to open up dual language programs in certain areas where they're losing students, right? Due to gentrification, really, and, you know, these new hip people that move into these neighborhoods that have no kids, right? Displacing families of color with young kids, and then you have maybe those families who send their kids to charter schools, et cetera. And so there's this loss of, you know, really funding based on the student population. And so, that's happening everywhere where, you know, these dual language programs are saving the schools in different ways, right? And by bringing that prestige, not just the numbers of students, but that prestige, in a way it kind of ensures the sustainability of those schools, that they will continue to have these numbers. And so definitely that is one huge impetus for opening the programs. And that's why it's so difficult to talk about these things, because these are schools that are you know, being closed, and teachers are losing their jobs, and they're also having to move to the suburbs, and you know, it's just a huge shift in the population. So it's, I don't know how it plays out in Philadelphia.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about Philadelphia, so Philadelphia has funding issues in general.
Yeah.
And they may be nationally known, the funding is, and there's this discourse of the dual language program. The one dual language program is in a gentrifying area, and they had this discourse of bringing parents back into public schools, which of course is problematic on many levels, but one is parents have been sending their kids to the public schools forever, so you're not bringing parents back into public schools. But there was a reporter who was doing a study, a story on the dual language programs that were happening in Philadelphia, and I was involved in helping to shape them. And the reporter talked to me about it, and I explicitly encouraged her and kind of begged her not to frame the story that way. And that's the way she framed the story. Because it's a really seductive narrative that people have kind of latched onto. And it completely ignored the five dual language programs in North Philadelphia, which is low-income, Latinx, and kind of focused just on this program, and ignored also all of the Mexican-American, primarily, children that were in that program, and focused on just the white parents in the program. And this was after me explicitly telling the reporter, that's not the story that I hope you tell. But she kind of, I don't mean to criticize her as a person, but I mean, I think she felt that was a story that would sell.
Right.
Ursula. Hi. Claudia, I'm Ursula. You know, thank you. Claudia, thank you so much for this work. I think you wrap up so nicely so many of the gut moments that many of us in dual language education would kind of see something or read something that sort of feels off, or we might write something that we know might get interpreted one way or another. We think, So thank you. Thank you for sort of giving place to this. I did want to ask both of you, really, because I think maybe... having come here is really great to hear some people's work on the ground around this racial justice and this reduction of prejudice work. You're pretty much calling on it, naming it and calling it for us to do explicitly. As someone who has kids in dual language schools and have experience with two very gentrifying neighborhoods, I lived in Silver Lake when I lived here in Los Angeles, and so when I say that, for those of you who know, it's a very gentrifying neighborhood. We brought a dual language program there, and I guess for me, and now I'm in Oakland, and again, it is literally reliving the next day, except 20 years later, because I'm in a school that had been historically a black and brown dual language school. that now is just sort of losing that. I guess for me the question is, and is maybe you can point to us, who's responsible for this kind of work, sort of long-term, right? Because I think, you know, we can put part of this work on teacher ed programs, but I think in California, some of our teacher ed programs do this work around conscientious instruction well, you know, at least for the tapping of. But that's just 2 years, and we all know that that's not enough. I think our work, my work at least, with even asking teachers who are bilingual to continuously use the language was difficult because of so much internalized oppression and prejudice. So this work is long-term work. Who do you see taking up this work? I think some of you, I'm kind of feeling like I'm tapping you because I think I know what you're going to say, but who do you sort of see this in the governance of this kind of work in the long term? How do you see this happening?
I focus on teacher education because that's what I do, but not necessarily because that's the only space where we need to be doing the work. In fact, I do think that teachers are overworked, and there's a lot that we put on their shoulders with very little support. So we demand things from them that we don't demand of the people that make the decisions that create the context
or even
for
other
to
schools,
to work,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think that, and this is something that we propose in our work on critical consciousness, that it should be the work that everybody engages in. And starting with administrators, right? I think there's a gap there in what we're doing with teachers and what we're doing with leaders, with school leaders, administrators, right? Really interesting, like in the schools in North Carolina where I worked, there was like the principals would try to do all, like promote all this work to be done with the teachers, but they weren't even there themselves, right? And so, you know, even the parents would tell me, well, you know, how come the principal doesn't speak Spanish if she believes so much in the program, right? So, and that was just like a little sign of like, how much are you invested in this and how much are you just pushing, you know, for others to do? So I think the leadership, I think that families, you know, all of us involved, right? And when somebody commits to a dual language program, in a way, we expect all these benefits, right? It's like you've said before, we're selling this program as, look at all the benefits, right? It's a very market-based kind of approach that we've used to attract families, just the idea of attracting families to the program. You know, we're selling a product. But really, these are schools. We're not selling a product. These are schools. These are communities. These are the lives of children. And so it's not about what am I getting from this, it's how am I contributing? So as a family, whether you are, you know, from a language minoritized group or from a privileged group, there should be that understanding that as you come into a school, this is not the mall, right? I mean, you are coming here to contribute in some way. You have to learn too. And for ages, we've been trying to teach Latinx parents how to parent because apparently they don't do it well, and they don't know, you know, what to teach their kids. And we teach them how to sit their kid on their lap, to read a book to them, and we think that's okay to do, but we don't think that it's okay to talk about privileged parents, about white privilege, or about other things that are certainly very damaging to not just their kids, but the communities where they are. So I think that this should be a collective kind of work that should involve everyone, from the social worker in the school to the librarian to, you know, everybody should be part of this. And that's why when we talk about critical consciousness, we are not wanting it to be like, oh, this is one more thing that we do. It should be what guides what you already do, right? So when you think about academic language, well, let's think about that critically, right? What are we implying by that? When we think about social studies, when we think about math, you know, everything that we do, it's about critically thinking about how we're perpetuating certain things and also about what action can we take, right? So definitely this should not be in the hands of teachers only, absolutely. And I'm sure people would have other ideas about who can contribute.
But I'll just add to that, because I think you answered it fine. That I also think that we have to work on the critical consciousness of scholars and academics who talk about the language practices of the students. In my work with teachers, they're using the terms and the concepts that scholars have created. Now, they may be using them in ways that we didn't want them to use them, but they're relying on concepts that we as a field have developed to perpetuate perspectives that we find now to be deficit, academic language being one that I find used in extremely deficit ways and in extremely imprecise ways. I mean, Guadalupe wrote an article, I guess it was like 10, 15 years ago now, that was kind of like, what are we even talking about when we talk about academic language? And so I think that we have to think about kind of the ways that we talk about as scholars and academics these issues, because oftentimes teachers are actually taking out the concepts that we oftentimes kind of suggest, so teachers aren't paying attention to research, but they get those concepts through professional developments, through other ways, and then they're using our concepts, and I think we have to own that and kind of really reflect on what we're doing and kind of think of our own critical consciousness in that way.
So I appreciated your comments about the issue of dual immersion not being the only possibility, and that if we use dual immersion as the program that has the best results, is the only possibility, what we end up doing in many of our communities is saying that English learners don't have access to bilingualism and biliteracy. And so I think it's really important that we talk about multiple pathways to biliteracy, not just one pathway, right? And so the whole, I mean, because we do want native English speakers in dual language immersion classrooms, right? Well, that takes spaces away, even if it's 50-50, even if we get the best composite enrollment in a classroom. 50 of those seats are not English learners. You know, 50% of those seats are not. And so in a school that's heavily populated with English learners, and they can't, they don't have that other native English speaking population there, so is there no alternative for those students to be in a bilingual program that leads to high levels of bilingualism and biliteracy? I think we have to be careful how we posit the dual immersion program as the solution, right? And so I appreciated you raising that and having us in the work that we do. So we had a piece of legislation that passed last year to fund programs who are either going to initiate or expand their current programs, and we were careful to say dual language immersion and developmental bilingual programs, both of them, right? And that 40% of the kids enrolled in either of those programs had to be English learners at the elementary level. Middle and high school, they could be English learners plus RFIPS, because some of the kids will have been redesignated, right? So I think that's how we posit this, to make sure that it, that we open space and that we don't shrink the spaces that are available.
Thank you, Courtney.
Yeah, I'm kind of going back, I'm sorry. But in talking about, you know, kind of the work that we do and the work that we could all do together for equity, I'm thinking a lot about the discursive formations of the discursive formations, and you know, how are we actually bringing parents and teachers into this work when a lot of this stuff is, you know, in a particular language, right? And that's the language of the enemy, right? Like, whose work is it then to actually bring parents into these discussions in a way that honors how parents are talking about it, whether we're mixed in or English? But you know, I think part of this work is it is a very isolated space, and you know, is there movement around bringing people into these conversations? Like the parents who are showing up, you know, as the gentrifying white parents. I think there's a hunger for thinking about, you know, the impact that they're having. They might be showing up with good intentions. They might be showing up with, you know, I want my kid to have a fun time so that they can employ Latinx people when they're adults. Like, there are those parents, but I think there are a lot also who are coming in with good intentions who end up having terrible impact, right? Because they're not aware of what this, you know, how those good intentions translate into PTAs. And you know, you have administrators who are seeing, you know, parent engagement in this really trademarked kind of way. Like, okay, so the Latinx parents can be told how to read a board book to their children, and the white parents can be suffered, but they'll bring us money. So we have two different, you know, kind of ways of relating. But I think that there is space and hunger for people to be able to enter these spaces in a positive way. So just sort of the question of how we are doing that work.
I think that's a really important point, and when we do the transition to the next panel, we're going to put up the goals that I laid out yesterday for us, and of course one of those goals is around the dissemination of this kind of discussion, into broader groups, and I think you're pointing right at that. I don't want to take any more time because I know there's a lot of thinking going on. Lydia?
Lydia. So sitting here yesterday, and when I went home feeling guilty about every decision I ever made, from when I was a bilingual TA to a special ed assistant to an administrator to a teacher, who did I harm? How did I, you know, not knowing. Now, honestly, that's, you go home thinking about everything you've ever done. And now in the role that I'm in, to influence the practice, I'm being reflective and thinking about, first, thank you again for including me in this. Because this does take deeper conversations, and the learning that I am gaining is an opportunity for when I'm speaking to board members who are voted elected officials, and people need sound bites, and there's that whole process there. How can I get them and myself to understand a little deeper the complexity of the work? But the other thing I've been thinking about when the issue came up about terminologies and what terminologies we use, limited English proficient, English language learner, all of that. I just came back to the identity issue because honestly, I mean, I even struggled with it as a kid when everyone thought I was just Mexican, but I actually had a Salvadorian biological father and stepfather. So I'm trying to wrap myself around how to explain to people, it's about the identity of the home, with every background and that complexity also, and how do we do that with language, socioeconomic, the community we're in, and the evolution of it, right? Because I'm in a new arena now, even with my own child, who I also want to become bilingual, who has brought a perspective to me regarding gender identity and how limiting the Spanish language is to my child's Sarah Juliet Stevens, born female, who actually now only wants to go by SJ, and is trying to determine what last name they want. So it's a lot of dynamics that go on in homes. So I think the family engagement, and I strategically say family and not parent, and we were strategic about that in our master plan, because it looks different for everyone. So I'm asking, where have you seen some lights of hopes and models of a group or a school that has been enlightened in some ways that I can then go to, visit, get people to see and connect to? Because we're in this arena and I'm thinking, but then I have to show, right? What does it look like and how can you think about it? So I'm wondering here in this room, in this country, where might be some models that are inclusive of everyone and every type of home as we bridge together? So that's what I'm trying to find as I unlearn, relearn, and elevate. So
that's a big challenge on the table. Where everybody is appreciated. There were several hands up, and I want to take advantage of every last minute that we have. So, we have 10 minutes. Oh, good.
Greg is calling on me. But I don't want to. Oh, so just building on that and Ursula's comment and what Courtney said, we don't have time to get into it now because I know we have a break, and breaks are important in these long conferences. But in addition to what you're saying is to think about things that already exist, but I would love to hear from the two of you and from everybody in the room, but especially Rhonda, about not just what exists, but what the vision would be. So imagine that you had some school districts and they were listening to you and they had bought what you were saying. Okay, absolutely, we're gonna revamp everything, and that Rhonda gets called in with her equity framework brilliance. What would we see in that school? And my guess is that you might not see it now in a lot of places, or you might see pieces of it in some places, but there's no place that's fully embraced, you know, this vision of really creating and really done that hard work of creating the racial equity and power symmetry in a new language program. So everything from like going back to Bob's call for concreteness what would the assessment look like? What would the curriculum look like? How would kids be greeted during the day? What would the signage look like? Would the principal always be speaking Spanish, maybe more languages? What would the parent groups look like? Who would be empowered to make different decisions? Those kinds of things. I would just love to get that conversation happening. So,
thank
you.
I think that sounds like a book, Susan.
Yeah. There you go. There's another book for you.
Can I build on that question before the way you guys answer? Ilana, Umansky. Again, thank you so much. I mean, I think one of the things that I sense from all of us is how you really are giving voice to so much of what we're sort of trying to grapple with in our work, and I just really appreciate the work that you're doing. And I think to build on what you just said, and I think I'm hearing it from a lot of people, I'm thinking about from my work as a policy researcher, like what do those big, you know, as I work with states, what am I advocating for? What questions am I trying to answer? Like, what is the, Lucrecia, you brought up funding, Francesca brought up student selection, like, you know, assessment, program models, where the locus of control is, like these big level policy questions, like how can we address the issues you're bringing to the fore from a policy perspective as well, as a practice perspective?
And then fix the world's problems too,
right?
Yeah,
you gotta fix it all.
I love your question because it really challenges us to think beyond what we're constrained by our context, and so to dream. And I love that. I think I need some time
to think about that, but I
do think that, you know, part of constructing that vision is the fact that it should come not just from one person, but like the imaginaries of many people, right? What is it that really is a meaningful education for our students? Not just for the sake of learning languages for the sake of it, or to, you know, to have an advantage over other people, but there's more that we want to have in an education, and a holistic education for our children, for all of them, right? And so I think that definitely what we talked about in terms of that critical consciousness and a Freudian kind of way, and I've seen it in place and in places where that don't have very much, right? And where kids are really empowered and empowering each other, and where teachers relinquish control, and where assessments are very subject, like the students themselves know that assessments are subjective, and there's just this very humanizing kind of perspective about what education means. So I know it can happen, but I don't think that it would be even right for me to lay it out for you, because it should come from you themselves, from families themselves, from communities, right? It should be a co-constructed dream. But I really love that, you know, to start moving in that direction of dreaming. I appreciate that.
So just to add to that, so I mean, I work a lot with teachers, and the reason I like working with teachers is because they always push, right? Like, what does this mean in practice, right? The first answer I give them is not one they usually like, but I do think it's worth reiterating here, is I think sometimes reflecting is an action, right? And sometimes you really need to reflect on how deeply the problems are embedded before we can even get to what are the solutions. So I would encourage us to kind of keep that in the back of our minds. Second, what I think I was trying to propose is really thinking about, so this is kind of building on, so one of my mentors, Jean Anion, who passed away a few years ago, her kind of framing of education policy was essentially to say education policy is all the things that affect schools, and that includes poverty. And so we have to think about how are we addressing issues of poverty in communities, because we know that when people are less poor, they're doing better in school for lots of different reasons. And so I think part of thinking about what this means for policy is thinking about policy, school language policy, bilingual education policy differently, and really thinking about it not as a silo but as connected to all of these other policies that we know have an impact on how successful those schools can be. And then in classroom, I agree with Valia that I think it has to be really a grassroots thing, but what I do with teachers is to really get them to begin to think really critically about some of these concepts that I have concerns about. And I don't have the answers to what we should be using instead of academic language or how we should be thinking about these things, but I think teachers, and I'm talking about teachers because that's who I work with, I don't work as much with parents, oftentimes don't have a space to really reflect on the terms they're using and the assumptions that go into those terms and the biases that may be implicit in those terms. And so I think starting there, starting from a place of critical reflection on what is it we're actually saying, what is it that we actually think we're doing, and what are we actually doing, I think is an important first step to then developing this vision that I do think has to be like at a community level. I think every community is going to be different.
That's great. Okay, we have one more minute. Magali?
Oh, you have 1 minute. Okay. So, getting back to the policy question, I think that one of the opportunities we have is the challenge where policy continues to use deficit orientations about English learners, mm-hmm. where the local control accountability formulas and the accountability tools that we have should be able to address the reallocation of resources more equitably, and we're really challenged in California about doing that. And some of the leading policy-making groups often are amenable to it, but they actually don't really get it. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Getting Down to Facts paper had really great papers, but they really have not addressed these issues of power and culture and equity straight on. They kind of go around it. They kind of go around it, but they really are needing to be pressed more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's an important. With respect to we're gonna shift now and take a short break. I'm sure picking up. But I do want to mention that we added 1/6 item to the goals, and I don't know if it's a goal, but this emerged from the discussion last night. Can we actually agree on what to call these children who we have been calling English learners in a very deficit way, focusing only on what they don't have? And so that's something else I think for the, along the lines of your talking about the deficit, the kind of deficit language that we use even to talk about the issues. Maybe people want to be thinking about how we shift the language and how we talk about these kids. Okay, thank you so much for a wonderful panel.
I will.
Okay.
it's a little different than that.
Sure.
A lot is in the 8-10. So it seems like if you wanted to go, would you rather go on your own, right?
Sure.
Or you could go with Deb Palmer. But she's in it, you know, she said it's 40 minutes before you, so it's really up to you.
Okay.
It's kind of whatever you feel like, you know what I mean? There's only like a few of you that gave me,
I've met her.
Yes.
I just gotta put a face on it.
Yes. And there's no pressure if you want.
What?
There's no pressure. It's just, you know, whatever
totally
works for you.
With connecting this, I mean, that's, you know, it's money and.
But it is a little bit earlier than you would need to be there.
That's okay. Yeah, she was saying yesterday. But that's only 40 minutes difference.
Yeah.
Let me just spend 40 minutes. Oh, we're going to be there.
Exactly.
So she's in Alton.
Right? Right?